Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the lobbyist and PR Mark Gallagher, founder of the agency Pagefield. Mark held communications roles at both ITV and ITN before becoming Director of Corporate Affairs at Camelot, where he transformed the company's PR and won the lottery licence for a third time. Returning to ITV in 2007, he battled against burdensome advertising restrictions and fought for product placement to be allowed on UK television. He left in 2010 to start his own PR and public affairs agency. Pagefield now advises some of the world's biggest companies on their strategic communications, including Airbnb, Discovery, Kellogg's and EDF. Mark, thank you for joining me.
Great pleasure.
Mark, you were just 28 when you were made ITN Public Affairs Director. Was that quite daunting to be made such a senior job at such a young age?
Well, now, Paul, that's a very kind question to start with. What was the beginning of your success in stellar success in corporate?
Tell us why so many people like and respect you.
I can see this is going to be one of the easier interviews that I do.
We should declare to our listeners that we are old friends.
We are very old friends. My goodness, 5-6 years of plotting together on various campaigns.
Indeed, long may that continue.
I guess starting in corporate affairs and starting my first executive board position at the age of 28. In some ways, it's not unlike parenting, starting your own business, any of those things. If you knew now what you knew then or vice versa, then maybe you wouldn't have done it at all. As it is, a very great friend of mine, and in fact, my old boss, Michael Grade, has a great phrase, which is part of it's luck and partly it's you make your own luck. And so I try to make my own luck by sort of cutting a dash when I first started in the business over at the ITV Network Centre, which gives you an indication of quite how long ago it was. As the Network Centre and the Association was the gathering of 15 independent ITV companies.
Wow.
Remember the days of Tyne Tees and Yorkshire and all
Television,
that?
Yorkshire Television, Granada.
So feels a bit Thames. More like 1896 rather than 1996.
They barely have a network now, never mind a Network Centre. So,
well, they're doing very well under the circumstances. Anyway.
Still on message after
still
all these years.
Still on
I like
message
it, I like
after
it.
All of these yeah. years. And of course, ITN, which is sort of broadly part of the ITV family, is a great client. In fact, one of the founding clients we had at Patreon.
We've had John Hardy sitting in that very chair. Lovely man.
A very fine man. So attempted to cut a dash on the lobbying side in my first sort of baby job, if you like, in the corporate world.
Did you always want to be a lobbyist?
I think from very, very early on, I started my career at a funny little charity called the Industry and Parliament Trust. And they tried to educate MPs and MEPs about business and business people about the parliamentary and political process.
Sounds like a front for a Colombian drug cartel, if you ask me.
Very worthy organisation. And of course, what that did is expose me to the delights of these strange folk called public affairs or corporate affairs professionals that I'd never come across before. Remember, early 1990s. The lobbying profession in particular in this country was very, very embryonic still. In those days, and certainly going through the 70s and 80s, corporates, if they're interested in political influence, very often went to, on the Labour side, to sort of left-inclined law firms. And on the right, it was very much the sort of very much the old boys' club. And it was really only at the point in which I first started working at the IPT that corporate affairs and public affairs and lobbying was beginning to emerge as a if not a profession, then certainly a trade in its own right. So I encountered these strange folk in public affairs and corporate affairs, quite like the look of it, really. And so I applied for my first baby lobbyist job at ITV Network Centre. And from there was headhunted by the great Stuart Purvis, the chief executive of ITN at the time, which is essentially where I got my lucky break and ended up on the executive board of ITN.
What did you do there?
So it was a combination of internal communications, PR, first time I was managing a press office, and the public affairs and the regulatory affairs. I've only ever really worked in companies that are heavily regulated and licensed, because essentially corporate affairs is mission critical to those companies in a way that it might not be elsewhere. So I'd certainly recommend to anybody who wants to make progress in the profession at an early age, always work for a company where PR or corporate affairs and public affairs is mission critical. In the nicest sense, I've got no difficulty with working for Widgets R Us, brackets Northampton, close brackets.
Which it would be a nice thing to do, but isn't mission critical.
It's not mission critical, exactly right. So really the full range of communications, because ITN, although very high profile as a company, was relatively small in terms of turnover and headcount. We were less than £100 million a year turnover, and we were employing 800-900 people. So very high profile, but of a small operation. So they couldn't really throw huge amounts of resources at the wider corporate affairs function. So it meant whoever took the director level job in that company was responsible for the lot.
How long did you do that for?
So that was a 3-year gig.
And with it being so tightly regulated, did that mean that you had to be more creative within the job rather than less creative? Because in one sense, you might think, well, it's very regimented. You've got very little wiggle room, as it were. Is that where you had to be as creative as you possibly could?
Well, Paul, I'll tell you what, the thing I found by far the most challenging was not the sort of regulatory straitjacket at all. It was internal communications. Which, like PR, I was doing really for the first time. So to an extent, Stuart had thrown me in at the deep end by employing a lobbyist and saying, I've just got a hunch you might be good at PR and internal comms, but he didn't know and I didn't know. So from that point of view, I really did get a lucky break in my career at that point. Internal communications for a company that employs roughly 900 people, of which roughly 700 are journalists. I mean, really, about the most challenging and cynical audience that you can get in terms
of... From the frying pan straight to the fire.
Any formal internal communication was bound to be looked on with a degree of a raised eyebrow and a furrowed brow from the 700-odd in-house journalists there. It was quite a challenge. Of course, it's one of the things that made it absolutely fascinating.
And also, that baptism of fire might have made you, because it sounds like to me you were thrown in at the deep end and then you did very well.
Well, it certainly confirmed something that I thought that I might enjoy, and that was confirmation that I did enjoy, which is throughout my career, really, and it's carried on right the way through my 6 years at Pagefield as well. I'm somebody that tends to run towards the gunfire rather than run away from the gunfire. And it's quite nice to know early on in your career what it is that you enjoy, as opposed to just what it is that you're good at. And again, it's something I would advise others to think carefully about in their first 10 years.
But you had quite the mix of responsibilities even then, early in the career, because you had public affairs, PR, internal comms. Did you get a sense of which bit of that kind of mix you liked the best, or did you like doing it in the round, all of it?
Lobbying was and is my first love. Corporate PR, issues and crisis management, again, you know, the sort of bullets flying around your head is a very close second for me. Internal communications, I like if it's a challenging time and a challenging audience, but if it's sort of day-to-day stuff, you know, you'd have to be a saint to thoroughly enjoy...
To enjoy editing the staff newsletter.
Really? You know, you know, we must be honest with ourselves about these things.
Well, we have to be careful. We've got many thousands of listeners that there will be people...
some of you may enjoy it, but it just wasn't something for me.
Not me.
The one thing that I find that I'm very... I guess slightly bipolar about in terms of whether I enjoy it or not is consumer-facing PR. So
outstand it. Loved the day that I got out of that many, many years ago. I wasn't very good at it, frankly, as well.
Now, I mean, there are aspects of the consumer PR that I've done in all of those, 20 years in the in-house jobs that were utterly fascinating. At ITN, you know, some of the scrapes that one or two of the newscasters perhaps got into, ITV... there were some hilarious stories about how some of the soap stars in particular needed a little assistance, particularly with the Sunday popular press, if I can put it like that.
I'm loving all this phrasing, by the way. It sounds great.
And particularly at Camelot, where we had some fascinating consumer PR gigs, particularly with the lottery winners. If you remember, you know, I mean, the fact is the National Lottery, which is a... to this day, is probably my single favourite company that I worked in during those 20 years, with no disrespect to any of the others, because I've loved all the jobs that I've ever had. Very lucky from that point of view. But the lottery, its great joy is it's a lottery, and therefore you don't choose who wins on a Wednesday or a Saturday or now virtually every day of the week with the various games. And, of course, those that are... less rich, if we can put it like that, are also the ones that really have to take publicity because they're not able to hide the win. Some of them have got fascinating and wonderful and heartbreaking stories, and where you have a real duty of care. And
because it could be the single worst thing that's ever happened to them, couldn't it? You'd see loads of stories about, you know, I won 20 million on the lottery, now I'm homeless.
And it ruined my life.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's that interesting combination of doing right by the winner, when very often you needed the duty of care was by far the most important thing, because they might have been vulnerable, they may have never handled money before. You know, there's a whole raft of considerations. It's a very, very personal thing. And I kind of loved that combination of the personal and the consumer. I had an amazing team who did it day to day.
Wow.
But I was called in from time to time when we had particularly challenging winners, if I can put it like that, who needed some additional care.
Challenging in what way? Rollins.
Well, you know, some
rogues.
There were some rogues.
Throwbacks.
In there. Again, it's one of the great joys of it being a lottery. Yeah. You know, it was quite, if ever there was confirmation that the lottery was not a fix, and in fact is something that is very fair, it is if you look at the press clip around lottery winners and you look at the breadth and depth of the people that win, it is quite clear that there are some of those lottery winners, without naming names, that if you're the lottery operator, you wouldn't choose to win in a million years,
because
they're usually bad publicity. And which is why it's so great. It's a fantastic organisation. Probably John Major's single biggest achievement after the Northern Ireland peace process.
I've never been a gambler. My dad always said to me when it came out, he said, I've just won 520 quid on the lottery. I've not played it once a week for 10 years. And I always remember that was quite a good adage.
You've got to be in it to win it, though, Paul.
Absolutely.
Remember that.
Absolutely. So what did the role involve? Because you were clearly dealing with the consumer, as it were. But then
yes,
there was also the regulatory framework,
yeah,
the legals, the actual business side of it as well. Were you responsible for all of it?
Camelot was the most extraordinary job that I had in the in-house world. I arrived there in 2003.
Was Diane CEO then?
Diane Thompson was the chief executive. She recruited me, as we often say to, we're great friends now, and we've not been working with each other, with me as her employee and direct report since 2007. So it sort of tells you a story. Those that work very closely together in the lottery very often remain sort of lifelong friends. It's a very unusual part of the jungle.
I genuinely have to think what year we're in now just to work that out.
That's so it's 9 years.
Yeah, so I've got a disconnect to reality.
Nine years since I left.
Wow.
And we're like close buddies. And as we often say to people, it was the biggest waste of 55 minutes of our respective lives, because it's kind of like dating, isn't it, when you go for an interview with your potential chief executive and boss, and you sort of know in the first 5 minutes whether the chemistry is going to work. So we were kind of treading water for the other 55 minutes of the 1 hour interview. And I think that's something that I'd like to share with your listeners, actually, which is that when you're sort of shimmying up the greasy pole of your career, or if you're working like me now in an agency, in this case, my own consultancy, Pagefield, it's really important to remember that thing about it being like dating. If the chemistry is not there, then it's very, very difficult to make that working relationship work really well. And you kind of know in the first 5, 10, certainly the first hour or two, whether that chemistry is going to work or not.
Senior PR guy once told me, it's like the clap, you've either got it or you haven't.
I think that's right. It's absolutely, I wouldn't perhaps have put it in quite those terms myself, but it's absolutely right. And particularly for the in-house role and particularly for the corporate affairs director role, and its relationship to the chief executive role, to a lesser extent the chairman as well, you have to have a relationship of trust, absolute trust. You have to have a relationship where they trust your judgment, because you're the one that's the first line of defense when things go wrong. And very often, as I say, if you're choosing companies and organizations where corporate affairs is very important, then you're very often the first line of opportunity, if you like, as well. And that was the other thing that was the great attraction of working at Camelot, really, which it was the fact that it had a terrible reputation at the time that I arrived in 2003. And we essentially had 3 years really, to turn around the reputation and to make a credible bid for the third lottery license. And if we had lost the company would have closed. So it was a win or die situation.
And let's go into that in a second. But actually, I just wanted to ask you about that trust, because there are different kinds of trust, not necessarily just loyalty per se, but competency, all of the other different kinds. Sometimes I've seen dysfunctional relationships in the media where there's the trust in terms of loyalty, but the person they're trusting, whilst they're loyal, isn't actually competent. So ends up, you know, messing the job up anyway. Because like you've just said then, Camelot had a huge challenge. Diane had to trust your loyalty, but also trust your ability to deliver it.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right.
How did you do it?
Well, once you've leapt the chemistry test hurdle, then it's about getting on with the job, establishing your credibility, and demonstrating at each and every turn that you are up to the job, that they've made the right choice of recruit. And my view is that certainly for the first 6 months, it is entirely incumbent on you as their preferred candidate to demonstrate that they've made the right decision. After that, that's true up to a point. But if it's not blindingly obvious to your board colleagues and to your chairman and your chief executive that you are competent and up to the job, then something's gone badly wrong. But until then, it's our responsibility to demonstrate that they've made the right decision. But also, in order to achieve that, there's got to be that relationship of transparency and honesty. I remember Di saying to me after the first month at Camelot, she said, "I know that you're great. It's quite apparent you know that you're great. So wow. let's tone down the latter a little bit, and let's not be quite so much like a bull in a china shop because you are upsetting one or two people." And you know what? I was perfectly happy to take that personal criticism.
Because it was meant kindly and constructively.
Partly because it resonated. You know, I'm certainly in a quiet taste and don't lack confidence, Paul, as I know very well.
You and I both have to hide our amazing excellence so that we can get by in society.
We certainly do. But therefore, I knew it was well-intentioned because it kind of resonated. And also, there was absolutely no reason for her to give me that very small bit of negative feedback or sort of room for improvement feedback, as I think we call it in HR terms these days. There was no reason for her to do that other than the fact that she wanted me to succeed in the job. And I have to tell you that, sort of nauseating though it might sound, if I look back on each one of my 5 significant bosses, I'm absolutely blessed from that point of view. I did get totally lucky. I didn't make my own luck. I just got lucky. So the amazing Ricky High Chambers over at the Industry and Parliament Trust, Stuart Purvis, the legend of every broadcast newsroom for the last 40 years, Di at Camelot, Richard Eyre, not forgetting him, over at the ITV Network Centre, and then finally Michael Grade at ITV. I mean, an absolute glittering array of very talented people, but each and every one of them very emotionally intelligent as well, which meant that my job in-house was made much easier because of that relationship of trust we're talking about, and externally, of course, made far easier because you and I both know that there are an awful lot of corporate leaders in the UK who aren't blessed with emotional intelligence, and it makes them much more difficult to deploy in either the media or the political environment. But if they are, as each one of my 5 were, then you're off to the races.
But it's also the ability to sense talent, isn't it? To literally hire and retain the right people. I mean, I employ just over a dozen people, and I can see that my most important decision, 99% of it, is in getting that right person. I mean, clearly they saw something in you that meant that they could deliver. It's great that they could then support and resource you properly. But part of it, I think, is the fact that they hired you in the first place.
Well, every single one of those 5, I would say in very, very different ways, because each of them are very different personalities. But my 5 bosses before I started Pagefield were not only blessed with that basic level of emotional intelligence, but each one of them in their own way was a brilliant team builder. Now, as you were suggesting, the two go totally hand in hand. I mean, really notable. If I think of, well, let's take my last boss before I left the corporate world, Michael Grade, over, who was then executive chairman of ITV PLC, as it then was. ITV had been in the doldrums one way or another for a long time. The previous management team did a terrific job. Charles Allen and his team had some serious challenges, which they pulled off with some aplomb. But the fact is that they had to focus their energies on unifying a very, very balkanized regional system into a single ITV PLC, certainly for England. And that consumed a huge amount of their time. So by the time Michael arrived, ITV was at last a unified company and still one of by far the most successful commercial broadcaster in Western Europe. But all of that energy had been expended on unifying the regional companies. None of it had really been spent on a proper response to the digital challenge, the kind of getting to a cost base and getting to a structure that allowed ITV to thrive in the digital age. And that was Michael's job.
It was quite, at that point, from my outsider's point of view, it was almost like a bureaucratic exercise to unify and get the logistics right and create one network. But it almost had missed the fact that it had to then be a credible TV network that had programs that people wanted to watch.
I think that's spot on. And I say it's no criticism of the previous management team, because their job, their primary job, as agreed and tasked almost by their shareholders, was to get that unified ITV PLC. But it did mean that more a disproportionate amount of management time was spent on that essentially rather bureaucratic process, certainly very regulatory type of process, again with corporate affairs in the forefront, and not on concentrating on the job of being a broadcaster, and in this case a broadcaster producer, very successful one as well.
I actually do feel sorry for ITV a lot, because it's a great channel, but you know, when I turn on my Sky Q box and there's 500 channels, there's only five of them that actually are regulated properly. The rest of them, they can stick any old channel up, and yet ITV has this burdensome framework of innumerable regulatory things that it has to, hoops that it has to jump through just to actually exist. It just seems unfair when you can turn on to channel 492 and be left with Men and Motors plus one that just puts on any old crap.
Oh, well, I would say two things about that. The first is that you're quite right, and successive Labour and Tory governments failed to deregulate ITV quickly enough to allow it to respond optimally to the digital challenge.
To be agile.
However, it's got to be countered with the other end of the telescope, which is that when I was first doing policy work in the commercial TV world in the mid-1990s, and we looked on to a world where there were 500 channels as a basic, plus everything else we now have with Netflix and Sky Box Office and you name it. You know, there's been a total revolution. The box in the corner of your living room is now a computer. It's got access to the World Wide Web. Everything that was predicted would happen has happened, and more besides. And yet, ITV still leads the pack as the largest commercial broadcaster in this country by a country mile. Nobody, when I first entered the industry in 1995, would have predicted that in 2016 every aspect of the digital revolution would have played out, and more besides, and that ITV was still raking in 10 million viewers for Downton Abbey on a Sunday night. Extraordinary. The survival instincts of old media brands like ITV are never to be underestimated.
And that's because they've got this legacy, this hinterland of this huge viewer base that they can leverage. One of my last consumer PR clients, you know, many, many years ago, was Trueprint, the photo developer.
Yes.
They didn't have that strong a presence online, but when they did, they got millions of customers because, you know, the older people had a brand that they could trust, the photo boxes and the Snapfishes of the world. They never heard of them, whereas Trueprint was something they remember from having the envelopes in the railway stations.
Absolutely right. But it's got to be a blend of two things. They've got to have that heritage brand that has some resonance in the first place, and they also then need a really spanking contemporary management team who understands the contemporary problem, or the challenge at least, and delivers the goods. The reason ITV is in such good nick now, which actually of course links back to what we were saying before about Michael Grade, in this case his ability to lure fantastically talented people into the management team of an organization that on the surface you think maybe wasn't going to be the easiest organization to recruit for. So he assembled this team. That team with him identified the problems and the challenges presented by the digital age, and they cracked on with the job. Actually, they got very little credit for it, we got very little credit for it as a management team, because it coincided with the advertising recession that kicked in 2008 as a result of the banking crisis. And so ITV's share price performance was very, very poor. I think we were down to something as low as 17 pence per share. And until Brexit, I think ITV was trading at 2.70 a share, so £2.70 a share. So there's been a huge uplift because, of course, the markets exaggerate the position of the real value of companies. So in share price terms, we really performed badly. But in terms of dealing with the underlying challenges that that company needed to face, it was a stunning management team and they did a stunning job. And the team that followed Michael Grade's time at ITV, which is Adam Crozier and Archie Norman, were a great team as well, but they benefited from us having made some really, really difficult decisions which had never been done before at ITV. So, and again, corporate affairs played a crucial role in that.
But sometimes PR and corporate affairs done well is something that has to be done behind the scenes. My friend Adam ran the PR operation for G4S for many years, and everyone used to say, oh, what a terrible job he did. And I actually think he did a fantastic job to mitigate the damage to the brand that the people running their prisons were doing. It wasn't his fault that people were escaping out of their prisons, but, you know, sometimes it's that mitigation of negative stories rather than just promoting the good stuff that can also be the hallmark of a good corporate PR person.
Oh, absolutely no doubt about that at all. And I would say that in terms of, if you like, headline performance, superficial performance, then out of all of the four significant jobs that I've had in the corporate world before launching Pagefield, my last stint at ITV, working with Michael and that incredibly talented team, was probably the least impressive in terms of the press clip. Because, as I say, you know, our share price had tanked and the markets were overreacting to the fact there was an advertising recession and.
But things would have been an awful lot worse, but for the fact that you guys were on top form.
Never worked as hard and never delivered more for longer-term shareholder value than any of my corporate gigs.
And yet, having had this litany, this conveyor belt of excellent bosses, you then decided to say a plague on all of their houses and set up on your own.
Yes.
What prompted that?
Boredom.
Right.
There we are. We've known each other for too long, so I'm very comfortable to share with your listeners the fact that my personal view is that good corporate affairs people have limited attention spans. In my case, I'm happy to admit that I very often got the attention span of a goldfish.
Wow, that long. That's double long. What I've got.
I genuinely hope this doesn't sound conceited, but the fact is that having got lucky with the job at ITN at the age of 27, 28, so I've been at the highest level that you can get in this country, at the executive board level. In the case of Camelot, I think I may have been the only main board director on the shareholder board who was also the corporate affairs director, in this case the campaign director as well. So combination of that, of luck and making your own luck, had enjoyed that very highest level with some of the most exciting corporate challenges of that decade. So it's approaching the all-important 40th birthday, and it's like, really, I've already done this at the highest level for 13 or 14 years, do I really want to do it for another 10 or 20 years? And the answer was no. Went for a very, very long holiday, a sort of posh version of backpacking. So I'd never actually got the backpacking in. I was too poor to be able to go for my gap year.
I can't be bothered with that. I want to see the world, but from a luxury hotel window.
Yeah, although I give you and the listeners one bit of free advice here, which is that don't do it for as long as my then partner and I did it, which was, I think, 3 or 4 months of proper five-star luxe.
Sounds great.
Which sounds nice.
But invite?
But by the time you get to the second month and you're watching some investment banker's wife complaining to her husband that her ice is too cold, that it can get a little grinding after a while. So I'd recommend taking that length of time off, but make sure you get some variation in your backpacking. So a bit of five-star followed by a bit of tactical slumming it is probably a better formula.
And did you kind of fly back, you know, was that return flight, was that where you decided to make a go of it? I'm going to set up this company. How did the name come? What were you going to do initially? How did you assemble your team?
So I'll paint you a picture. I committed to myself that our farthest point of travel, which in this case was the, I think it was the Hyatt Hotel underneath the bridge in Sydney Harbour, overlooking the Opera House. And I was on the terrace of this hotel room. My partner had found some friends and was out nightclubbing. For anybody that knows me, they won't be surprised to hear I then ordered up a jug of Negroni and a packet of Marlboro Lights from room service, settled down with a notepad and a pencil, and just started to write. to try and crystallize my thoughts as to what it is that I wanted to do next. So I wanted to give myself a cutoff point, because it would have been so easy for a 6-month sabbatical to turn into a 12-month or an 18-month or a 2-year sabbatical, and you begin to lose momentum. So our farthest point was Sydney. It was at the end of April. I'd left ITV Christmas of that year, so it was a goodly amount of time. And it became very apparent very quickly with my brain in that beautifully cool, chilled sort of state, what I wanted to do. And I wanted to stick to corporate affairs. I'd tried some general management and really hadn't enjoyed it at all. I really enjoyed negotiations. I negotiated Camelot's bid for its third lottery license, the only negotiation I've ever done, 55 billion quid's worth.
Well, we all have to start somewhere.
We all have to start somewhere. And I enjoyed it, but I knew I didn't want that to be the primary focus of my job. Certainly knew general management didn't want to be the prime focus, but I didn't want to carry on just doing a corporate affairs director's job at that level in-house. So it became blindingly obvious through a process of elimination that really the only option was to scratch that little entrepreneurial itch and to launch Pagefield, which is what I did in I was planning to do it in January of 2011, and then my partner and I only went and adopted a couple of babies back in the autumn of that year. So I thought, well, somebody's got to go and earn the school fees. So off we went.
Why Pagefield?
Pagefield
is with a mining town, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the name of a colliery in Lancashire. That I was owned and run by my mum's maternal family way back when, like turn of the century. And then my maternal grandfather had adopted that name to launch his engineering company, first in the north and then when they migrated south, in the south as well. And I just kind of love the idea that it told that story of familial entrepreneurialism and the fact that there was a proper story behind it. And that I could point to the fact that the family's always had that entrepreneurial gene. It told a nicer story than you know how some of these PR agencies' names have been born over the years, which is just a bit more superficial, I guess.
Tell us some of the highs and lows since you've started it to where you are now.
Wow. Okay. And my goodness, for anybody thinking of leaving the corporate world and starting their own agency, Paul is absolutely right. There are highs and there are lows. There's no doubt it's a roller coaster. And if it's not a roller coaster, something's gone badly wrong. And as I see Paul nodding vigorously at this voice, I know you're in the same position as a fellow entrepreneur.
I have to focus in these podcasts of shutting up, because I'm quite chatty, as you know, whereas it's people want to listen to hear you, not me.
Go on, you can share it. So, you're nodding vigorously because you agree that it's a proper roller coaster. The highs are very high, the lows are very low. I've enjoyed virtually every minute of it in those 6 years, but then I'm a slight adrenaline junkie. So even when you've got a very low, again, it goes back to that thing at the very beginning about discovering that I sprint towards the gunfire. Others are not like that. So take this as a warning from history, listeners. For those that don't get the adrenaline rush from the very highs and the very lows, don't touch it with a barge pole. If, on the other hand, you're like your Uncle Mark and you're perfectly happy with that roller coaster, then come on in. The water's lovely.
I like how the fact you've already addressed our listeners as you saying that you're their Uncle Mark. I quite like that.
Well, a lot of them will know me, I should imagine. Anyway, so highest high was probably... Do you know, it was sending our first invoice, not because of the money, but because it felt like a proper business. My goodness, there's an invoice that's got Pagefield at the top and it's got a figure of money that you're sending to your first client.
Was it paid?
And it was actually.
Even better.
Thank you, Camelot. You were my launch client and I shall forever be grateful. And I think one or two of the lows, I remember I've got a... I pride myself on having a great track record in terms of team building, and it's very interesting and a reminder that these are not bad people, by the way, but if you recruit people who are not quite the right fit, how quickly the atmosphere can sour and how important that is in a team. So, you know, I'm speaking really bluntly about that. I mean, I have the most incredible team, and the team we have right now is... out of this world. In fact, my proudest single moment is hosting a dinner party for Pagefield's 5th birthday. And we invited all of the staff and all of the former staff that were good leavers. Every single one of the buggers turned up. And that made me very proud, because they didn't need to do that on a wet Thursday evening in October, but they did. So there's a good that we're almost at the stage now, 5 or 6 years in, where we've got our own kind of like ambassadors network of former staffers who are now doing the most extraordinary stuff. Our Kate Levine is now Global Corporate Affairs Director for The Body Shop. You were interviewing Stig Abel the other day.
I was indeed.
And he's gone on to the most extraordinary things in journalism. I mean, the man's got a brain the size of a planet. You've again got...
Don't remind him. He listens to this podcast and he'll listen to that.
The wonderful Simon Redfern. He's gone on to be the European Corporate Affairs Director at Starbucks. I mean, it's almost like a finishing school for...
You're like an incubator unit, aren't you, top talent?
Yeah, it's a splice between an incubator and a finishing school. I prefer finishing school, yes. Paul, to be perfectly honest.
I'm from the rough north, so... what is the bread and butter of what you do then? I mean, let's say a brand new generic client comes to you tomorrow and they've got money, they want to pay. What problem would they have and how would you solve it?
So, the problems they might... Well, it doesn't need to be a problem. It could be an opportunity.
Ooh, I like that.
We have a very straightforward service offer. So we do corporate PR, we do issues and crisis management, we do lobbying and public affairs, we do regulatory, or I'd prefer to think of it most of the time as deregulatory affairs.
You're trying to lessen the regulatory framework. You're trying to kind of get a bit more laissez.
Just cut them some slack.
Yeah. Give them a break.
We are in the business of cutting business some slack, whether it's media breathing down their neck, whether it's politicians or others breathing down their neck, whether it's regulators that are breathing down their neck. Our job is to say the businesses we work with are fundamentally good businesses. They're doing good stuff. They're creating wealth. They're employing people. They're enriching their shareholders. They're producing goods and services that people want to buy. So let's work on the starting point that unless it's proved otherwise, that by very clear evidence, business is good. Business is not bad. Business is good. And they just need some friends in the world of media or politics or regulation that are going to hold their hands in what can be a very cynical series of interconnected jungles to allow those businesses to flourish better. Now, in reality, that means great media relations and great issues and crisis management and great regulatory affairs and great public affairs and lobbying. But at its simplest, we are here to allow businesses to thrive even more than they already do.
And how do you persuade a regulator to be kind of less burdensome and less onerous? I mean, the only thing I've ever tried to ban in terms of Parliament was the sale of foie gras, which I know you and I would disagree on because you would want it given away on the streets.
I have to interrupt you, Paul. Listeners, note the chippiness of the left winger to the Tory boy here. Little does Paul know, despite our 6 years of friendship, that I am actually a bunny hugger, and I too would support the banning of foie gras.
Wow.
There you go.
Well,
learn something new every day.
Well, but I failed to ban it. I remember kind of, you know, chatting with Ben Bradshaw, who was the then animal welfare minister, and he said, I can't ban it. You know, there's no desire or appetite higher up the government to do it. We don't want to fall out with the French, whatever contrived reason.
I'd say that's a jolly good reason to do it. But anyway, we'll get on to Brexit later.
So what would you have done had you were me? You know, there you are sitting with Ben Bradshaw, and he basically says a polite but firm no. What do you do? We'll say, thanks for your time, and I'll sling me hook.
Got to make it worth their while. Got to make it worth their while. So sometimes it's about just about the clarity and the intellectual consistency of the argument. Far more likely, it's you know, every single politician is only human. They want to get re-elected. If they're in government, they want to stay in government. If they're in parliament, they want to stay in parliament. And you have to understand the fact that, I mean, the overwhelming majority of parliamentarians that I've worked with in my first 25 years in the business are well-motivated, broadly, very intelligent, very tuned-in individuals, and they're overwhelmingly there for the right reason on all sides of the house. You know, you're a Labour person, I'm a Tory person, but you'll meet good Tories, and I meet good Labour people all of the time. And actually, I would say that there's something in the corporate affairs world, we need to do a better, much better job as for any of us who are lobbyists, in talking to people who are not lobbyists and who don't understand politics and the parliamentary process the way we do, that these guys are well motivated And our job around a dinner party is perhaps to defend those parliamentarians of whatever colour just a little bit more than sometimes we're prepared to do.
And also defend lobbying per se, because I consider it a noble pursuit. I wasn't very particularly good at it over the years. I'm glad I don't do it now. But, you know, speaking to someone like yourself who's a very good lobbyist, PR has bad PR. And I still think that lobbying is tinged in the general kind of psyche of the public as something that's a bit dodgy and a bit behind the scenes.
Absolutely, and no doubt about
it. Unfairly deserved, I would say.
No doubt about it. I was at a dinner party last night in the South Downs. There we are, totally conforming to Tory stereotype. And no foie gras on the menu, Paul. Somebody who I'd never met before basically accused me of being sleazy because I was a lobbyist. I mean, setting aside the bad manners.
So we can't advocate violence on this podcast, but I hope you clocked him on the nose.
Well, metaphorically, he got both barrels.
Good.
And the reason he got both barrels was exactly what you're intimating and I'm agreeing with, which is that lobbying is a noble profession, or at least can be. If I think back to virtually every lobby that I've done in-house or agreed to do in consultancy and agency, I've not agreed to do it unless I believe in it. I don't need to be passionate about it. It could be something which is quite dull. Let's face it, they very often are, some of those commercial lobbies. But where you've got a legitimate company with legitimate owners and shareholders, a great management team, good staff, all the rest, and they just want to be left alone to get on with their job, and they've got some completely unaccountable NGO breathing down their necks. An NGO that, by the way, is more often than not likely to totally fail their own tests that they set down for corporates around transparency, accountability. And there's a really interesting debate to be had about the role of NGOs, whose influence, in my view, is far more pernicious. Let me say that again, far more pernicious than the impact of most corporates in this country. And they should be held a bit more accountable. But anyway, fact is, lobbying, noble profession. If you're a lobbyist like you, in your previous incarnations, where you choose carefully who your clients are, who your employer is, and what campaign you're running, I've never, ever run a lobby campaign that I've been ashamed of. And I've only ever adopted campaigns where I have a natural enthusiasm, or the team that I'm heading have a natural enthusiasm, because Westminster, Fleet Street, Whitehall, whatever it is, they're small interconnected villages, and people smell the authenticity or the lack of authenticity. And just being a hired gun for anybody who's prepared to cut you a check, your targets on behalf of that client will tell straight away.
I think my biggest challenge of the critics is that it's lazy thinking, because you're not going to risk your career by doing something that's dishonest or dodgy that's going to come back to haunt you, but neither would the client, frankly. There is only one way to do these kind of things, and that's openly and transparently, because if not, you're going to fail the smell test, and therefore the government or the minister, whoever you're trying to lobby, is going to run a mile, so it's going to backfire.
Paul, I entirely agree with you. However, it does link back to one other point. And at the risk of sounding, both either of us sounding a little self-flagellating, the fact is that as a profession, we have been especially poor at promoting and defending the reputation of lobbying. I mean, more generally in communications, we're seen as either sort of stupid or superficial or sleazy or whatever else it might be. There are a whole series of
wrong-uns.
Ab-fab wrong-uns of one sort or another. But lobbying in particular has had a very, very poor rap. We've got to find a better way as a trade, we're not a profession, but as a trade, of communicating to the rest of the world the good work that we do, because that's part of our license to operate, as we know.
The problem is, I imagine you'd have the same problem that I have, though, which is that if you had a true client case study, you know, first of all, you've got a confidentiality issue, but a lot of our case studies would be the client was in a complete disarray, didn't know what they wanted, and at the end of the process, they were all, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet, they had a coherent strategy, and they got on with it. But you can't have a strategy that kind of you know, humiliates your client at the beginning and said, oh, they had no clue at the beginning, because of us they now have a clue. But sometimes that is the client journey, is it not?
You're right, but I believe I've identified a solution to this, which is to have a gentle canter through contemporary history. So I'm not able to talk about a lot of the lobbies that I'm working on right now, because we've not gone public with them. We're preparing the client. We're preparing all sorts of interesting campaign grids and strategies.
Preparing
and
the client. What a great phrase, isn't it?
Anyway, I've been in this business too long, haven't I?
Well, I'm going to use that.
Anyway, but what I can do, as I did to this fella last night down in the South Downs, who was accusing lobbyists of being sleazy, or the trade being sleazy, said I gave him five or six examples of lobby campaigns that I have fought and won historically, but which could still be found interesting. So at ITN, for example, I spent 50% of my time running lobbies that protected freedom of expression for broadcast journalism. Very poorly drafted legislation, Data Protection Act, Representation of the People's Act, an attempt to regulate and license filming on the streets of London, which we had abolished totally as a bill because it would have effectively given local authorities, not even the national government, local authorities, the right to regulate where ITN and the BBC could film on the streets. You know, pull the other one, Sunshine, it's got bells on.
I was gonna say, this is like North Korea or something.
Yeah, well, your previous government. Anyway, the fact is that I spent 50% of my time as an in-house lobbyist at ITN running lobbies that protected freedom of expression for broadcast journalists.
But what's that?
Just by talking about those examples, you transform somebody who's outside the profession's understanding of what a lobbyist does, because they think big oil paying organisations like us to pollute the seas and cut down the forests. That's the sort of caricature.
Did you persuade him, though? I mean, this guy from last night, you know, because some people aren't persuadable.
I'm not sure I did that particular one last night, but I shall leave it between him and his God to understand, to appreciate why he might not be persuadable.
So, penultimate question. We're going to do the issue of Brexit toward the end, but just in terms of... But first, very briefly, what's next for Pagefield? Where do you want to take the business over the next 5 years?
Well, to an extent, I think I'd like us to just continue doing right what we're doing. We leap out of bed in the morning to deliver great public affairs, deregulatory affairs, great campaigning, issues in crisis management, all the stuff I've spoken about before. We've got the lowest client churn in the industry by country mile out of the sort of medium-sized agencies upwards. Last year, we didn't lose one client and whatever, 60-odd on the books.
Well, we didn't lose one client either. We lost about 10.
You managed to get to double digits, Paul. Well done.
We didn't really, listeners, for the avoidance of doubt. It was me being hilarious.
So the fact is that more of the same would suit me and the team, I think, down to the ground. I hope it would suit our clients as well. Would we go abroad? Probably not. But we would certainly think about strengthening our relationships with our sort of doppelgangers overseas. We're members of a brilliant network called Echo, and they effectively are made up of a network of independent agencies, just like Pagefield, but in all sorts of territories. So I'd like to do a bit more work there. I'd probably like to win one or two more challenging overseas clients to be represented here in the UK. I've always wanted to do a bit of work with the state of Israel, which I think is a fascinating challenge. One was the only liberal democracy in the Middle East, and it's managed to pretty comprehensively screw up a lot of its PR. Then I'd love to get my hands on that. I've been doing some very, very detailed work on that this year.
It's like the ideal PR case study, isn't it?
Kind of is, really. And would certainly love to do, after my Brexit work this year, I would love to do some more political campaigning because it's reminded me of quite how much fun it is.
Well, we've only got 2 minutes left, so come on then, tell us about Brexit. You even persuaded me. I was a Remainer, and then I came out and wrote a big piece in HuffPost saying,
"That's it, that's my boy. Let's go." Right too.
Do you just not like foreigners? I did laugh like Muttley then.
I think my American partner might have something to say about that.
They're different to us, aren't they? So we should leave. Is that the argument?
That is the argument. No, you're right. It is the argument. Yeah. We have a different legal system. We have a different
Cleverly pivoted there. I like that.
We have different economies. We have different regulatory systems. We have different everything. I said to a bunch of people at a dinner in France, a year ago, they were all French, and but very sweetly, they'd agreed to speak in English during the dinner party. And they said, "Why are you so difficult, all of you Brits, about Europe?" And I said, "Why on earth? You want us to stay? You know, we we dithered in the 50s when we could have helped mould it in our own image. We sort of begged in the 70s with De Gaulle saying, no, we finally got in the 70s. Thatch, God rest her soul, started handbagging the Eurocrats from 79 right the way through to 1990. I mean, a non-stop pummeling. And we've been hokey-cokeying around the European Union for the last 50-odd years. Well, I said, why on earth would you want Britain as a member of the European Union? We're nothing other than a pain. Well, why don't we just have a great divorce rather than a bad marriage?
Well, the argument would be, you know, the treaties of Maastricht and Amsterdam invoked the kind of principle of subsidiarity. We didn't have the euro. We opted out of all the various social chapter, which the government of the day didn't like. We kind of, I mean, I suppose the opposing argument is that we'd reached a settlement that worked for us and largely worked for them.
Well, I think if you're mentioning all of those treaties, the one to mention is the Treaty of Paris 1950, where we had an opportunity to join our friends on the other side of the channel to lay down the foundation stones for what became the European Coal and Steel Organization, eventually became the EEC and then the European Union. If in our sort of immediate post-war imperial arrogance, we hadn't thought of them as other and we'd got stuck in the 1950 discussions of the eventual treaty, we would have been able to help shape the European community and the European Union as it eventually became under Anglo-Saxon principles, within which we would have felt a good deal more comfortable. As it was, we didn't. We stayed isolated. The French and the Germans effectively became the motor for an organization with which eventually we were never, ever going to feel comfortable. I'm thrilled that the country voted to leave on the 23rd of June. And I think although a lot of businesses are quite startled right now about the kind of essay crisis that's generated with the sort of regulatory and other challenges that they face, certainly with the work that I've been doing on the, if you like, the roadmap to Brexit in the last few months, I think we've got every chance of knocking their socks off. And our political objective, for those of us on the Brexit side, has got to be that we bring as many people who voted Remain as possible with us for what's going to be an extraordinary ride.
Matt, we have 60 seconds left before we're thrown out the studio. What is the one piece of advice you would give to someone starting out in their career that wants to be the next Mark Gallagher?
Cool, you certainly want to be the next Mark Gallagher. But what I would recommend is a lot of hard work, lot of diligence, but absolutely crucial and really crucial, I think, for this, which is although we've characterized my career in terms of running towards the gunfire, always also remember that you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar, and that being nice and being polite will get you a hell of a long way.
Mark, it's been a pleasure to know you all these years, and it's been a pleasure to interview you on this podcast. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!